titles that tell a story in themselves.
The Bohemians, Mark Twain and the San Francisco writers who reinvented American literature.
Burning Down the House, Jack London and the 1913 Wolf House Fire.
I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea.
In his latest book, Ben Tarnoff examines the life and times of San Francisco writers Bret Hart, Charles Warren Stoddard, Ina Kulberth, and Mark Twain. And coming up, Tarnoff talks with Rosemary Manchester. Jonah Raskin joins us later in the broadcast and talks about his pop-up publications, Burning Down the House, Jack London and the 1913 Wolf House Fire, and his very personal A Few French Scenes. So stay with us. It's a novel idea. The 1860s on the West Coast was not only a place emerging, but a sensibility as well, and whose influence rippled across the country. Ben Tarnoff reveals the literary culture through the nexus of writers, the young and pre-Huck Finn Mark Twain, the lively and passionate Bret Hart, struggling gay poet Charles Warren Stoddard, and California's first poet laureate and mother hen of the group, Ina Kulberth. Here's Ben Tarnoff in conversation with Rosemary Manchester.
Ben, your book, The Bohemians, is absolutely a delight to read. How can you miss with a book about San Francisco in the last century and the talent that gathered there?
It's a wonderful subject. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was something I've always wanted to write about. So, I mean, you know, growing up in San Francisco, I always wanted to write about California history. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't sure how. Mm-hmm. And Mark Twain, when I discovered how formative the years he spent in San Francisco were, really gave me a vehicle for talking about the history of the West and the Civil War and the railroads, and all of these themes just kind of converged in this wonderful way. And that's when I knew I had to write the story.
The impetus that brought people to San Francisco, to California, was, of course, the Gold Rush. But this is some years after the actual Gold Rush. Would you set the scene for us in San Francisco?
Yeah, my story opens in early 1860s San Francisco. And as you mentioned, the Gold Rush has really waned by this point. The big deposits have been dug out. But San Francisco is still hugely prosperous because it's discovered alternate sources of wealth, mostly in the sea trade with Asia and the eastern United States, in the trade also with the vast Pacific interior. It's also a financial capital of the West, an industrial capital. And it's also financing several mining strikes throughout the region, particularly in Nevada, where the Comstock boom explodes in 1859, which is this huge resource of silver and gold. And it vastly enriches really the handful of San Francisco barons who finance the development of those mines. So San Francisco in the 1860s is a very rich city.
Mm-hmm. And now let's bring your characters onto the stage. I think of Mark Twain making that dreadful, dreadful journey by stagecoach and landing in Virginia City and then finally coming onto the stage in San Francisco.
That's right. Mark Twain first visits San Francisco in the spring of 1863. And at that point, he's been living in Virginia City, Nevada, which is this Comstock boomtown, for a couple years working as a journalist. And he comes to San Francisco and absolutely falls in love. He says later that San Francisco was paradise to me. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason he loves it is that it's such a big city, such a dense city. There's so many opportunities for socializing. There's these wonderful kind of after-dark amusements. He writes a letter to his mother saying that he usually doesn't come home to his boarding house until after midnight. So he's living large in the big city. And he also comes into contact with a handful of other young writers who are part of this emerging bohemian literary scene in San Francisco of the 1860s.
Mm-hmm. I've been to Virginia City, and I always think of the Bucket of Blood Saloon there, which is so famous. And Mark Twain was still kind of a rough character when he came to—I mean, we think of the guy in the white suit.
Right.
This was not the guy in the white suit yet.
No, and one of the reasons I really loved learning about this phase of Twain's life is that it really contrasts so sharply with our image of Twain, which is the man in the white suit, the kind of Hal Holbrook version mm-hmm. of the somewhat grandfatherly demeanor mm-hmm. of the later Twain. The Twain in my story, when he's in his 20s and 30s, you know, his emotions are much sharper and they're closer to the surface. He's quite vindictive. He's angry. He's competitive. He's terribly anxious. He's filled with fear about his future. He's convinced that he's going to end up in the poorhouse. So he's a very volatile individual. And he's also in this kind of very formative embryonic phase of his writing. Mm-hmm. And so in San Francisco, it's really a crucial time for him. Specifically, his encounter with this bohemian scene really molds him to literary maturity.
And he was found out he was great on the stage.
That's right.
Yes.
And that discovery happens in San Francisco. Twain mm-hmm. returns from Hawaii, where he has this wonderful trip and writes these fantastic travel letters that really gave him training in, you know, the travel writing genre that will mm-hmm. produce later The Innocents Abroad. Mm-hmm. Twain returns to San Francisco and is desperately poor once mm-hmm. again, decides he needs money. So he books the city's largest venue and fills it to bursting and delivers this hysterically funny one-man show, really closer to what we think of as stand-up comedy today, about his adventures in Hawaii. And this really launches what will be a lifelong career for him on the lecture circuit.
Mm-hmm. Along the way, at one point, he had a job setting type as it was called a printer's devil. The irony of that to me was that later on, when he was quite a success and had built his beautiful, beautiful mansion in Hartford, he invested, well, most of his investments were unwise, but this was the worst one, in a machine that would automatically set type and never worked out. Now, what irony.
Yes, definitely. No, it's quite a tragic story, really, because his foolhardy investments, particularly in the Page typesetting machine, really leads to his bankruptcy mm-hmm. and to this terrible period of his life where he's forced to essentially tour the world mm-hmm. as a lecturer to try mm-hmm. to repay his debts. But that's right. He gets his start as a typesetter's apprentice, mm-hmm. which, you know, many young men with kind of little formal education and little money would go into typesetting. Bret Hart also does it, Walt Whitman, Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin called it the poor boys' college. It was a way to get an education if you couldn't pay for it. It's a way to learn to read and write and also to be able to put some of your own contributions into print. Mm-hmm. So from an early age, Twain is actually writing for an audience.
Now, the character with whom I was least familiar was Charles Warren Stoddard, the poet. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Charles Warren Stoddard is really the boy wonder of the Bohemians, and he's the youngest of the circle. He starts off as a poet, actually, and goes through a series of quite intense personal crises, which relate partly to his sexuality. He's gay, and that's a fact that he's kind of constantly struggling to square with a world that really doesn't offer many outlets for it. His breakthrough, both personally and kind of professionally, come from when he travels to Hawaii, which he does quite a few times throughout his life, and he discovers this tropical paradise, which he loves for a variety of reasons, but he also has a number of love affairs with local Hawaiian young men and writes about these adventures quite beautifully and comically in a series of sketches that will be collected as the South Sea Idylls, mm-hmm. which appears in 1873 and is, in my opinion, really his best book. And after that, you know, he continues to write, but I think he doesn't ever quite reclaim that height.
It's interesting how many writers and also artists were really liberated by their experiences in Hawaii and the South Seas. I don't think we know enough about that part of the history because it was so essential to their really opening up.
Exactly. You know, Twain also has this wonderful experience in Hawaii. And he loves it. He spends 5 weeks in Maui relaxing. He says he doesn't write a word. He really takes a vacation. Another thing that happens to Twain in Hawaii is that he scores this incredible journalistic coup because a clipper ship named the Hornet actually has this awful crash. And a number of men survive in a boat, in a lifeboat, which washes up on the shore of Hawaii. And Twain interviews them. And that interview appears in a California newspaper, and it's the first report from, you know, the direct words of the survivors. And it goes viral, to use a term from today. Right. It's reprinted throughout the country's newspapers, and it's one of the early efforts by Twain that really makes him a national figure.
There were so many newspapers in San Francisco. That seems very unusual. What, there were 60 newspapers?
Yeah, there were many, many newspapers. Actually, if you go to the Library of Congress and search for that decade between 1860 and 1870, you find more than 300 papers. And some of those are only around for a week or two, and they're also in a variety of languages, you know, Chinese, English, French, German, and some are weekly, some are daily, some are monthly. But it's a very rich publishing climate, and it's really financed by San Francisco's prosperity. And California, you know, from the beginning is an especially literate frontier because the emigrants to California tend to have fairly high literacy rates because the cost of getting to California is prohibitive to the very poor. So we're not talking about people with a ton of formal education, but at the very least they could read and write. Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, San Francisco has printing presses, it has newspapers, it's publishing its own books, periodicals, pamphlets. So the written word is very important to California.
Mm-hmm. It's the land of opportunity.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, in the book I say that even the shaggiest miner aspired to bardhood, you know, that everybody wants to write poetry and literature in California.
Amazing. Would you compare it to the internet today, which has its headquarters in very near San Francisco?
Well, I think there are interesting parallels and interesting contrasts. One thing about San Francisco this period, particularly before the construction of the Transcontinental Telegraph in 1861, is that it's a very isolated place. You know, its only contact with the rest of the country comes from a steamer that arrives every couple weeks. So part of the reason for this flourishing print culture is the city's isolation, that San Francisco has to entertain itself. Whereas today, the picture, I think, is very different, where the internet has, you know, networked the globe so effectively that the notion of San Francisco needing 300 papers seems kind of silly because we have access to so many types of media just through our computer screen. And the other thing to keep in mind is that printed word is really the only form of media in that time. I mean, obviously, there was no television, there was no radio. So part of the reason for that explosion of print media is that people really need a form of entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Bret Hart, let's talk about him next.
Bret Hart actually grows up in Oakland, partly. Mm-hmm. He's from upstate New York originally, but comes west with his mother and stepfather to Oakland. He has kind of an interesting life. He suffers from smallpox at an early age, which leaves scars all over his face. He's a very shy, quiet child. He spends a lot of time locked in his room reading. He loves Charles Dickens. It's his favorite. And in the 1850s, he basically takes off on this kind of rambling tour of Northern California countryside and ends up actually as a typesetter for a paper called The Northern Californian, which was in a town up in Humboldt called Uniontown at the time. I think it's now called Arcata. And that's where he kind of gets his start in print. And what happens there in 1860 is that there's this terrible massacre of members of a local Indian tribe, the Wyotes. And Hart, in print, very courageously denounces this massacre and calls out the white racist vigilantes who had perpetrated it. And this, as you might expect, enrages the community and puts his life into danger. So he actually has to flee town and comes to San Francisco. And that's how he originally comes to San Francisco in 1860.
Mm-hmm. We certainly learn a lot about racial prejudice in reading your book. But let's bring Ina or Ina?
You know, I've heard it both ways, and I think I actually say it both ways, too.
So. Call her Ina. Ina Coolbrith. She didn't have an easy trip across the country when she came to San Francisco.
She certainly didn't, no. And she, you know, her childhood is really quite traumatic for a number of reasons. I mean, she's growing up in the Midwest as a Mormon. You know, her parents are early members of the Mormon Church in the Midwest when Mormons were violently persecuted. Joseph Smith, her uncle, the founder of Mormonism, is killed by an anti-Mormon mob in jail. So her mother actually decides to leave the church, marries a non-Mormon, and they head off west across the country on the Overland Trail to California. And they end up settling actually in Los Angeles. And back then, Los Angeles was really a small village of kind of a few thousand people. And Ina, you know, has this terrible misfortune of marrying a very abusive man named Robert Carsley, who actually tries to kill her. And they have this terrible divorce. And then she also gives birth to a child who dies. So all of this happens by the time she's 21. So she's kind of endured a lifetime of tragedy by the time she's, you know, just a young woman. The family decides that they're going to move to San Francisco, and Ina's going to bury her past and start over. So they do that in 1862. And she's always written poems ever since she was a young girl and actually acquired a certain local reputation in Los Angeles as a poet. And in San Francisco, she continues to write poetry, and her poems bring her into contact with the other members of the bohemian scene, like Bret Hart and Charles Warren Stoddard.
And she is chiefly known to people in California as the one who set Jack London on the path. But that was after the time that you're writing about. I was delighted to learn more about her because to me she'd always been almost a footnote in terms of Jack London. And she's a remarkable person in the way that she became friends with these young writers and was kind of a mother figure to them. They hung out at her place and she fed them and took care of them. It was rather charming.
Definitely, yeah. She has this wonderful salon in her family's house on Russian Hill, which they all remember later as being kind of the most peaceful place on the planet, where they would hang out and kind of discuss the latest literary papers that they were about to publish. So she's a very important figure, but also a very important writer of her own, and contributing poems really throughout this period. And, of course, later in life becomes California's first poet laureate.
Yes.
So she's finally earns the recognition that she deserves.
Yes. And she was not a full-time writer. She had to support herself. She was a librarian and a teacher. And it's remarkable that she was able to have a literary life in addition to all of her other duties.
Yes. And that's a subject, you know, that she herself is quite angry and sad about in her own correspondence. You know, she looks at her friends Bret Hart and Charles Warren Stoddard, who basically get to write and travel, and she feels stuck in the Bay Area. She describes it as her convict life, you know, this prison that has kept her rooted in place. And the reason for this is that she has this household to support. You know, her sister dies, and she has to take care of her sister's two children. Her poet friend Joaquin Miller deposits his daughter on her doorstep and says, "Will you raise my daughter?" Her father runs away from home, leaving her with the care of her aging mother. So for all of these reasons, she has to take a job as a librarian in Oakland, where she spends a number of years. And, you know, there are bright points, like you mentioned Jack London. A young Jack London wanders into the library, and she really kind of guides his reading material. And he will later write these wonderful letters describing her as his literary mother, as a goddess, you know, that he couldn't have become a writer without her. So she does have a very positive impact on the younger generation, but she herself, I think, feels quite resentful about the fact that she has been forced into this life of drudgery that she never wanted.
I'm so happy that she did achieve the recognition of being poet laureate. You know, I just felt personally happy for her that she was recognized that way.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting period because when that happens in 1915 at the actually at the Panama Pacific Exposition, it's also California's way certainly of recognizing Culbreth, but also recognizing the significance of that generation of writers that we're now able to look back and say this period in San Francisco's literary history was really a golden age.
Yes. I think our listeners have picked up on the fact that you have done a tremendous amount of research.
Yeah, I find that, you know, often I would do a certain amount of research up front just to kind of get the lay of the land and develop some type of preliminary structure about how to move forward. But I find that a lot of the writing and the research is kind of inseparable from each other, that one is kind of guiding the other. I would find it very hard. I know some writers like to do a big block of research and then a big block of writing. And for me, the two never really felt so consecutive. You know, they're really kind of constantly informing each other. And so that was kind of the spirit in which I proceeded with this book as well.
Well, did you have Post-it notes all over the wall or how do you do this?
Well, yeah, I would say Post-it notes are a big element. You know, I have various kind of note-keeping programs on my computer. You know, I wrote most of this book at the New York Public Library, where they have this wonderful room for writers called the Allen Room, which I was very fortunate to have access to. So they also kept a number of the books I needed on a shelf for me, which was very useful. So I was kind of based there when I wasn't doing the archival research, which mostly took place, I would say, at the Bancroft Library in Berkeley. About 70% of my archival work was there. I was also at the Huntington in Los Angeles, a little bit at the Oakland Public Library and the San Francisco Public Library, and at a couple places in the East Coast as well.
Do any of the libraries on this coast have a writer's room like that?
There are certainly many wonderful, quiet places to write in the San Francisco Public Library, but the wonderful thing about the place at the NYPL is really that dedicated shelf, you know, so you don't have to lug those books with you everywhere you go.
Yeah. Also, you had a very interesting discussion about facts and truth. Could you talk a little bit about the balance between what we call facts and what we call truth?
I think, you know, when you imagine history, for me, it's important not to see it just as a transcription of facts. You know, it's easy to kind of go into the archives and just dig up these huge masses of material. But it's important to digest those masses into something that feels a little bit more realistic or kind of a little bit more human. Truths don't really matter unless they feel like they mattered to real people. Mm-hmm. And I think most of my work as a writer is trying to make those lived facts of real people's experiences feel real to the contemporary mm-hmm. reader as well. Mm-hmm. That if I tell you how many people died in the Civil War, for instance, or what date Mark Twain first arrived in San Francisco, that's just data. And that data needs to be animated within a certain narrative, within a certain context that makes it feel alive.
Your title, The Bohemians, Mark Twain and the San Francisco Writers Who Reinvented American Literature. Wow. I got very, very interested in the term bohemians. In fact, I went to the dictionary and the definition that I chose is, see if this fits. This from Random House Dictionary, bohemians, pertaining to or a characteristic of persons with real or pretended artistic or intellectual aspirations who live and act with disregard for conventional rules of behavior.
That sounds absolutely accurate.
Mm-hmm. And
definitely.
It comes from Paris, of all places.
It does, yeah. Really, the term appears around the 1830s in Paris. Kingdom of Bohemia is thought to be the homeland of gypsies, or Roma, as we would call them now. And so that term is used to describe this kind of tribe of poor artists who are loafing in the cafes. They call them the Bohemians. And that word actually migrates to New York in the 1850s, where a handful of artists and writers hang out at a downtown bar, who also call themselves the Bohemians. Walt Whitman is probably their most famous member. And it also appears in San Francisco, when Bret Hart starts using it in his column, his regular column for a literary paper called The Golden Era, and he signs these columns The Bohemian. So all of these bohemias, I think, share in common that definition that you just mentioned, which is, I think, something countercultural. Mm-hmm. You know, the lifestyles vary. Bret Hart doesn't live a bohemian lifestyle. You know, he has a steady job, he has a wife, he has an infant son. He's not drinking, he's not partying, he's not poor. But he does believe in creating a creative space outside of the mainstream, that he sees the need to resist what he sees as the deadening influences mm-hmm. of California's materialism on its culture.
Is it important that Bohemia no longer exists as a place? I mean, it's kind of Brigadoon. You can't go there.
Exactly. It is important. You know, Bret Hart in one of his early columns says Bohemia has never been located geographically. So the idea that it's this imaginary place where a lot of different types of people can join, but it doesn't have to exist physically. It can exist in the mind. That's a very important idea for these writers.
Would I be way off if I thought that there was a certain amount of smugness in being declaring oneself a Bohemian?
Certainly. And Bret Hart, I think, can fairly be described as quite smug.
Mm-hmm.
He can often be quite condescending. He's deeply ironic, even sarcastic at times. He's really trying to distinguish himself and the other writers he admires from the California mainstream, which he denounces in various forms as being full of hypocrites and Philistines and sentimentalists and capitalists. So he's always trying to push himself away from the kind of core of California, mm-hmm. which is an irony because, of course, California mm-hmm. really claims him mm-hmm. as its greatest writer.
Mm-hmm. So it's push-pull. I want to be famous, but I want to be me.
Right. Well, there is this kind of interesting push-pull relationship between, you know, the leading citizens of San Francisco who are proud of Hart because he's an emerging writer on the national scene, and Hart himself, who's always trying to push those people away, who kind of feels that he's above them.
And such an interesting character.
He is, yeah, he is.
I don't think he'd be much fun to spend much time around, but he's fascinating.
Well, I think once you were in his confidence, he could be extremely kind, you know, to Ina Coolbrith, to Charles Warren Stoddard, even to Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm.
His loyalty, you know, in this period, later he kind of self-destructs and these better kind of virtues of his aren't as evident. But certainly in this period in San Francisco, he can be a wonderful editor, a mentor, a friend. You know, for all three of these writers, particularly Twain, he really helps them improve. You know, he's really a major factor in Twain refining his style and Twain becoming a great American writer.
Does the term Bohemia carry a political connotation?
It's interesting. I think it can, obviously, in local contexts. I think in San Francisco in this period, it's hard to say that it does. I think its spirit is consistently contrarian. In terms of entering the local politics of the time, Bret Hart and really all of these figures are Republican. They're pro-Union. They're pro-Lincoln. Hart writes this beautiful poem when Lincoln dies, which occasions this dramatic march through the streets of San Francisco. So they're all supporting the Union. But beyond that, I wouldn't say that Bohemia carries too specific of a political connotation.
Okay. Now, another part of your title of your book that we haven't talked about is the reinvention of American literature. When I think of American literature at that time, I think, of course, East Coast, Emerson, Thoreau, and the big names. Tell me, how did these poor people way out here on the West Coast, whose lifestyle was bohemian, whose writing was not particularly classic or polished, but the strength of their writing seemed to be the colloquialisms.
That's right. I would say the biggest impact on American literature in terms of style comes from Mark Twain and Bret Hart. And a lot of that has to do with their use of dialect,
yes.
This kind of deeper use of vernacular, this notion of vernacular not as a kind of distortion of proper English, but a more imaginative use of it, really discovering the kind of homespun metaphors, this wonderful homespun poetry of local, ordinary American speech. I think that's absolutely critical in something that they share. Also, the sense of irony, which really comes out of a frontier humor tradition, a really kind of dark, almost what we would call sick humor, which has so much to do with the history of the settlement of the West and the kind of tragicomic aspects of that, and these wonderful oral traditions in the form of tall tales and kind of frontier jokes that influence both of their styles and which they infuse into American literature in quite a radical way. I think more broadly, when we think of the bohemian scene in San Francisco, for this scene in California, which is only a decade or two removed from the days of the gold rush, for them to have produced two of America's most famous writers and to build this incredible literary paper called the Overland Monthly, which for a period of time is one of the most prestigious papers in America, and it's actually a real competitor to the Atlantic Monthly, it has a real impact on American culture in proving that the Pacific Coast, that California, can produce literature on par with the Atlantic Coast. You know, that New England doesn't have a monopoly on American high culture, that in fact great writers can grow anywhere. They can grow out here in California just as well as they can grow in Boston and Cambridge and Concord.
Mm-hmm. I got out my textbook of California literature and I thought, well, it would be good for me to read these people. I had a very difficult time getting through the celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County and the others, which, and I realize I bring to it my contemporary point of view. You know, I'm not thinking about how it would have been like to read that at the time it was written, but I find it very hard going. You know, it seems innocuous.
Well, it's funny because that sketch, which originally appears as Jim Smiley and his Jumping Frog in 1865, is Twain's first real success. I mean, it makes him a household name for the first time. A journalist observes that it set all New York in a roar, and it's reprinted around the country, and people find it hilarious. And it's funny because when we read it now, you know, we might smile here and there,
right.
But it's not, you know, there are no belly laughs are going to happen when we're reading that these days. But I think it's such a fascinating sketch because to my mind, it really shows Twain making an important discovery about his own power as a literary artist, where he's starting to claim the kind of literary materials of the frontier, partly from the tradition of frontier humor, which has formed him since he was a child. He's starting to take those materials, that slang, those characters, that rambling flow, the kind of sounds of the voice, and he's starting to use them to really create literature in a way that I think distinguishes both, you know, draws a distinction between that and his previous work, but also, more importantly, draws a distinction between his work and those of these other humorists who are also doing similar things, but I think not quite achieving the same literary mode that he discovers. And I think there's really a straight line between Jim Smiley and his Jumping Frog and Huckleberry Finn.
Mm-hmm. And as you point out, he frames the story of the celebrated Jumping Frog by putting it to be a story that someone told to him. And that way he can launch into this buffoonery as almost as an alter ego. He's just telling a story. And that's rather a sophisticated technique, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting. He inherits this device from a type of frontier humor known as Southwestern humor, which was really the type of humor that he grew up on in Missouri, the old Southwest of Missouri and the surrounding states. And one of the frequently used literary devices of that type of sketch was the frame, where a kind of educated, gentlemanly type would introduce this backwoods society and would allow the backwoodsmen to speak a little bit, but they were essentially buffoons. They were ridiculed. Originally, it was actually used as a political tool to show how these kind of Jacksonian, Democrat-leaning frontiersmen were too stupid to govern themselves. You know, it's actually kind of a Whig plot to show them as buffoons. So what Twain does is he takes that genre and he inverts it, because suddenly the joke is no longer on the frontiersman. It's actually on the educated narrator, because the frontiersman is the smarter one. He's the one who's speaking in these wonderfully vivid similes and metaphors. His language is extremely expressive. He's running circles around this educated narrator who's completely flummoxed and is clearly the kind of victim of a joke, of a practical joke, of a hoax, mm-hmm. of which there are, you know, many hoaxes mm-hmm. on the frontier. So that's one of Twain's many innovations that he's practicing in this mm-hmm. sketch.
So the sophisticated guy turns out to be the frog that's full of buckshot, and so he can't jump.
Exactly. Yeah. And more broadly, you know, what this is saying, I think, is that the West isn't just an uncivilized version of the East. It's a civilization mm-hmm. of its own, mm-hmm. and it can inspire original works of art, mm-hmm. and that you don't have to defer to your Eastern elders. We don't always have to see the West through Eastern eyes. We can mm-hmm. actually see the West through Western eyes. And that's something that Twain really brings into the heart of American literature.
Mm-hmm. And yet, we spend a lot of time whining about the Eastern literary establishment. I say we, as you know, the people in the who write in the West and who love the West. And I think we have an kind of an inferiority complex that we can't seem to get over. That it's them and us, and they've got power that we don't. For one thing, I think publishing it has been traditionally centered on the East Coast. And maybe that's why I think of it as a literary establishment in capital letters. And everyone says, oh, to get published, you must have a New York publisher.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, more broadly, California, and I don't want to make too great a claim because there's a range of opinion in the East.
Yes.
But I think California is often seen still as a less serious place than the
yes,
East Coast.
Yes, of course.
And that's something that you feel
that we're flakes,
quite right. often. Flakes, the kind of right. land of the lotus eaters
right.
is a term that
right.
comes up.
Yes.
And this is a very old prejudice in American history. I mean,
yes.
I think that prejudice is there from the beginning. I mean, from mm-hmm. the first time that America pushes into the interior, there is a certain amount of scorn and condescension mm-hmm. that the East views the frontier with. And mm-hmm. the frontier is always seen as a kind of lesser stage of mm-hmm. development.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, California is no longer a frontier in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that perception of East and West still remains with us.
Should we care?
Well, I think that we should. I think it matters because, we obviously there's a lot of wonderful writing going on in California. But the fact that so much of media is concentrated in New York, I think that those opinions do matter. And I think that affects what type of stories get published, what type of books get bought. So I think that we should care.
One of the things that interests me about Mark Twain is that he got his start as a journalist and a lecturer. And is there that much of a difference between being a journalist and being what we call a writer or an author?
Well, back then, I think the term journalist is used a little bit more loosely. I mean, when we think of journalism today, we often think of kind of the objective, so-called objective mm-hmm. style of journalism of kind of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the type of journalism that Twain and these other Westerners are practicing in kind of the wild frontier is very different. I mean, Twain is writing essentially these kind of surreal comic sketches, these very provocative hoaxes, these kind of wonderfully rambling, strange digests of local details. So journalism in terms of kind of reporting facts are something that Twain was never particularly comfortable with.
Will you take the story from where you left it off? Will you do a sequel about particularly about Mark Twain and the others?
Sure, yeah. Well, so I guess I leave off with Mark Twain really in the 1870s.
Yes.
So he's just publishing Tom Sawyer.
Mm-hmm.
He's working on Huckleberry
mm-hmm.
Finn. He's really approaching the height of his literary powers.
Mm-hmm.
And Twain, after that, suffers quite a lot of misfortune and
so
tragedy.
Sad.
His later
yeah.
years are very, very sad. Particularly after the death of his wife, Livy.
Yes. Right.
He kind of enters this period of depression that
yes.
he never really recovers from.
Maybe a lot of has been written about Twain at that part of his life. And you found a part of his life that wasn't so well known and brought that to us, which is a tremendous gift.
Oh, thank you.
And to bring the other writers into focus as well. It's I find myself thinking about them a lot, sitting around Ina Kulbrist's salon. Is that house on Russian Hill still there?
It's no longer there, but there is an Ina Kulbrith Park on Russian Hill.
Oh.
So you can go and kind of commune with her spirit there.
Yeah. And it was a golden age.
Certainly.
Thanks so much for coming in. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you about this wonderful book that you've written.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. And let me remind our listeners again, the book is called The Bohemians, Mark Twain and the San Francisco Writers Who Reinvented American Literature. It's written by Ben Tarnoff. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
It's KRCB's A Novel Idea.
Away down yonder in Yankety Yank, a bullfrog jumped from bank to bank, 'cause there was nothing else to do. He stubbed his toe and in he fell, and the neighbors all say that he went too well, 'cause he had nothing else to do. And just lots of folks is like this foolish frog of mine, a-running into trouble just to pass the time. And devils all is loafing round here just to grab the kind that never has nothing else to do. Preacher said, the reason why this young frog is dead, 'cause there wasn't nothing else to do. And all you frogs, just listen to me, you better stay at home with your family when you have nothing else to do. And just lots of folks is like this foolish frog of mine, running right into trouble just to pass the time. And devils all is loafing round here just to grab the kind that never has nothing else to do.
This is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Jonah Raskin spins his curiosity and experience into books that include The Life and Times of Abbie Hoffman, American Scream, Allen Ginsberg's Howl and the Making of the Beat Generation, Field Days, A Year of Farming, Eating, and Drinking Wine in California. And he's edited The Radical Jack London, Writings on War and Revolution. In 2013, to commemorate 100 years since Jack London's masterful Wolf House burned to the ground in Glen Ellyn, California, Raskin toured Sonoma County giving talks mostly at public libraries and a memorable evening at the Sonoma County History Museum. He drew no conclusions but presented a lot of rich material as to what might have happened that night, which he shares with us in his recently published Burning Down the House, Jack London and the 1913 Wolf House Fire. Rosemary Manchester talks with Jonah Raskin about this short volume, along with his pop-up memoir, A Few French Scenes.
The new book that you've come out with, which is currently available at Copperfields, is called Burning Down the House, Jack London,
yes,
and the 1913 Wolf House Fire.
Right.
You tell the story in the book of how you were asked to give a lecture about the fire, and then this book developed from that, I think.
Yes.
I mean, it's something that everyone seems to know about. I mean, even people who haven't been to Jack London State Park somehow know that he built a house and it burned down before he lived in it.
Right.
It's almost a mythic episode.
Definitely. And yeah. So the more that I gave the talk, the more that I, by the end, the last talk that I gave, I pretty much said that I thought if anybody did it, it was Jack London himself.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because mm-hmm. he said, if I didn't think I would be happy in the house, I would burn it down myself. Mm-hmm. And because he was a very self-destructive person.
Oh, yes.
As you pointed out, his drinking like a fish,
right,
smoking cigarettes,
right,
a workaholic,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Burning the candle at both ends. Right. You know, he said, I'd rather burn than rot.
Right.
So, you know, in 1913, the same year that the fire took place, he was really depressed and suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
And he told a friend of his that he was afraid that in this sort of state of mind that he was in, where he was not always aware of what he was doing, he would take one of the guns and put it to his head and kill himself. So he said, I don't want that to happen, so I don't want any guns to be in the house.
For goodness sake.
Well, if he was capable of that, of thinking that, it seemed to me he would be capable of also get into a state where he wasn't had a lot to drink. And his doctors told him, if you keep drinking, you're going to die, you're going to kill yourself.
Yeah.
And drinking and smoking, that he could have accidentally, on purpose, set fire to Wolf House.
Yeah.
I mean, Charmian also, just one other little story. Charmian would, they had separate bedrooms, and he would get into bed with a book and some paper and pen to write, and he'd fall asleep with a lit cigarette in his mouth. And the cigarette would roll off and start to burn a hole in the linen, and Charmian would come in and get it and put it out.
For goodness sake.
I mean, that's really playing dangerously.
Well, it's a wonder he lived as long as he did.
Yes, and wrote as many books as he did.
Right. Do you remember someone local wrote an opera about Jack London?
Yes.
I think you and I were both at the premiere of that at Sonoma State.
Right.
And I thought it was an odd choice to focus on the book about his drinking, what John Barleycorn said.
Right.
But I remember at the end of it, it was so dramatic. There were people standing around the perimeter of the auditorium all around howling like wolves.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was wonderful.
Yes.
I loved that part. And I wish that someone would choose, well, you know, the story about burning down of Wolf House. That'd make a wonderful opera.
Yes, also because there's lots of other people who are involved.
And
There's Charmian, there's his stepsister, Eliza, there's...
there's an architect.
Yeah, there's that, right, Albert Farr. there's also the person who Jack London had, he was plagued with identity theft.
Oh, talk about that. Jack London's doubles.
Right.
I'd never heard about that before until I read this book.
Well, there was a couple people who were traveling around the United States, mostly in the West, and who claimed to be Jack London. Now, just the other day, I got some new information about this, the double. This is the person who was pretending to be Jack London. And Jack London called him my double.
Oh.
So a friend of mine who lives in Santa Cruz, who also does research about Jack London, sent me about 6 newspaper articles I had never seen before about the double. They were newspaper stories.
Yes.
Over a course of several years about this man, where he was in Nebraska and presenting himself as London, the police looking for him. And apparently the most interesting piece of information from these newspaper articles that I saw was that the man looked like Jack London.
No.
Yes. So that people saw him and they thought, well, this is Jack London, because
oh, my goodness.
They said he looks like him.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I love the motif that you have through this book of the fire and the number of times that he used the words fire and fiery and full of fire. And
yes.
It's fascinating when you analyze the language of his work and then, you know, how it all ended in this conflagration.
Right. That's exactly the word I was thinking.
Yeah.
So when I gave the talks and I pointed out, he said things like, I'd rather burn than rot, and I would burn, if I wasn't happy, I'd burn it down myself. Or when he's in The Call of the Wild, he talks about a writer who catches fire and produces great work. So people said, well, that doesn't prove that he set the fire himself. But
it doesn't prove it, but you're putting together a group of things that happened to indicate that was possible.
He thought about fire a lot.
He did. Right.
And those 2 short stories, to build a fire.
To build a fire. I was trying to think of the name about the last match that didn't work.
Yeah. So
That was a great story. Yeah. I like the fact that we'll never know. We can come pretty close. You can build a good case, but we'll never know. And then you'd run across people at your lectures who would have family stories of someone who was involved.
Right.
That must have been fascinating to you to pick those up.
Yes, right. And then I just opened the book to an early section. One of the people that I've gotten to know is Jack London's great-granddaughter.
Yes.
Her name is Tarnell Abbott.
Mm-hmm.
She lives in Oakland. So I'm just reading from the booklet where she said, "I don't want to think that he started the fire, but I can see that he was capable of that kind of grand act of self-destruction. I tend to accept the spontaneous combustion theory because I hate ambiguity. We might never know for sure, and in that sense, we have to accept ambiguity."
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so it's, as you say, it's we'll never know. Mm-hmm. We'll never know for sure, not after all these years. And
I never heard anyone accuse Charmian of doing it, but probably someone who
Oh, some people have, yes, because she apparently had an argument with Jack, and she said somebody overheard the argument.
Uh-huh.
She said, "You'll never live in this house."
Yeah, yeah.
So,
And it's hard at this remove to analyze things that have only come down through oral history. That
yes.
Charmian is said to have said, and that, you know, nobody was there taking notes. And so it must be difficult for you as a historian to weigh all that input of could have been, might have been. But you present it as a could have been.
When I would talk in the library, I would say to people, you know, I'm going to give you, like, all the information that I have.
Yes.
And, you know, you can make up your own mind about
right.
this.
Right.
I don't really have a stake in trying to prove, you know, one person or the other.
That's right. No, you're not trying to prove anything. You're just trying to find information about the incident to illuminate.
Yeah.
Illuminate. There we go. Fire talk again.
So it could have been the double who did it.
That's right.
I mean, he'd stolen Jack Lennon's identity.
Mm-hmm.
He was writing checks.
Mm-hmm.
He was introducing himself mm-hmm. to women as Jack London mm-hmm. and proposing mm-hmm. marriage. He was mm-hmm. presenting himself mm-hmm. as a reporter
mm-hmm.
doing stories.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody who did all of that
mm-hmm.
sounds mm-hmm. to me like mm-hmm. he could have upped the ante and mm-hmm. started the fire.
He was the evil twin, wasn't he?
Yes.
Hard to think of Jack London with an evil twin because he was no angel. But I guess anybody can have an evil twin if you're well known like that, yeah.
And he was in the Sea Wolf, the captain of the ship called the Ghost does actually have an evil twin.
Oh, for goodness sake!
So he was concerned. He was thinking about that also.
Right, and then with all that alcoholism, he wasn't really thinking that clearly, was he?
He called it the white logic, which is sort of not.
There's a euphemism.
Yes, not really logic at all. But under the when I you're drunk, intoxicated,
right.
It all seems to make sense. But
right.
somebody outside of the circle of right. the alcohol, right. to them, it's not. It's mm-hmm. nonsensical.
Yeah, and it's lovely that you got this material together and wrote it down. And so we could go down to Copperfields and get the book.
Yeah.
I want to spend a few minutes on your other book, A Few French Scenes, which
yes.
I found just charming because it's such a personal book.
Yes.
It's your love affair with France.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
Right.
And, you know, it made me think of M.F.K. Fisher.
In
right. your moving through the landscape and presenting the landscape to us with your views on it and how you were at the time. Most of the time you were freezing.
And yes.
we forget how cold it is in those places that don't have central heating and how uncomfortable you can be.
Right. And where I was staying with my friends
yes.
and outside of Toulouse, I mean, they had the heat on all the time. I probably would have froze to death if they didn't have the heat on. You know? So, yeah, I was talking to somebody about my book the other day, yesterday, and I said, this is about how I was cold in France.
Cold. That's what I was going to that book about, how Jonah was really cold in France.
And then I mentioned it to a friend of mine who... he said, well, the French are cold, too. They're cold all the time in the winter.
Well, maybe that's why they're so cranky. If people would like to have your book, A Few French Scenes, how could they get their hands on it? Could they write to you?
Or yeah, they could send an email to jonah.raskin@sonoma.edu.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So the way that this book came about was I told a friend of mine who's French,
mm-hmm.
who edits a website mm-hmm. that's called Swans, that I was going to France. And he said, well, why don't you write a travelogue for Swans? And, I said, okay, that sounds like a good idea. So the first chapter in the book is I wrote before I even went to France, where I was, in my head, I was already in France. I was thinking about it. So at the end of the day, I would get out my laptop and I'd write up what happened that day or the days before and send it off. And so the first time it was published was online on Swans.
Oh.
And then I came back and decided to put them together in this booklet.
Yes.
So I did that right away.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But you made the reader shiver.
Right. Well, then there's a lot about food.
Oh yes,
different kinds of food here.
Oh yeah, that's what made me think of Fisher, right?
And then there's quite a bit about books. There's an interview with this.
Oh yes,
the French author that I met.
Yes, and you went to look for the grave of Camus.
Yes. Yes. Right.
Yeah, that was an interesting expedition.
Right. Right, you know, so...
I remember one thing you wrote in that really struck me, that in France was the first time you'd seen the effect of gunshots on buildings. That must have been quite an experience.
Yeah, when I was a teenager, I was in Paris, and that was still when the French and the Algerians were fighting.
Oh, yes.
And there were explosions and there was gunfire in Paris. I think probably it was the last time.
Mm-hmm.
That there was really gunfire in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Joni, you know, I've always admired not only the quality of your writing, but the way you devote your life to writing. And you're so productive and you keep working at it. You're like Jack London in that respect. You keep writing.
Right.
So keep writing, because your work is it just gives me so much pleasure to read it.
Right. And I did notice that people like this. My friend Patty Trimble calls it a mini memoir, a pop-up memoir. So I think that the pop-up memoir, if people are interested in writing, I can recommend the form of the pop-up memoir.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. In other words, don't spend the rest of your life working on your epic. Just write something.
Yes.
And, of course, you're a very accomplished writer, so you wrote something very good.
Oh, well,
and the rest of us will do what we can.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Jonah.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Jonah Raskin and Rosemary Manchester. Earlier in the broadcast, we heard from Ben Tarnoff. Music at the break was Joan Morris and William Balcom. We've had a production assistance from Sean Knight. Rosemary Manchester and I will be back next month. Visit krcb.org, where you can subscribe to our podcast and listen on iTunes. Thanks for listening. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's KRCB's A Novel Idea.